The year is 1942. The month is November. The subject of Peter England's book is an intimate history of the turning point of World War II. Mr. England, who is based in his native Sweden, features close to 40 people from around the world and what they were doing during that month and year of World War II. In the note to reader, Mr. England writes, "This is a book about November 1942, the month that marked the turning point of World War II. At the start of that month, many people believed that the Axis powers would be victorious. By the end of the month, it had become clear that it was only a matter of time before Germany, Japan, and Italy would lose."
Hi, it's Nate from C-SPAN. Imagine, 45 years ago when there were just a handful of television networks, C-SPAN first went on the air, bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Shannon from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of over four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Peter England, who did you dedicate this book to?
Well, I dedicated it actually to my teacher, one of my first teachers at university, Josef Lewandowski. He was a surviving Polish Jew who eventually emigrated to Sweden very late because he was one of those who were thrown out of Poland in 1968-69. In the anti-Semitic campaigns that were ravaging Poland at that time. And he came to Sweden and he became a university teacher. And as I said, he survived the Holocaust. He fought in the Red Army from 1943 until 1945. He was participating in assaulting in the storm of Berlin, the battle for Berlin and so on. And he was an excellent teacher, full of stories. Because if you're a young man growing up in Sweden, you will, big history isn't what you meet in a natural way. But this one, my teacher, Josef Lewandowski, he had experienced so much that we were just reading about. That's why I dedicated it to him.
Before this book on World War II and the people that you quote throughout the entire book, you did one on World War I. What was that book about? And as I understand it, there were about half as many people that you quoted in there or talked about than there is in this book.
Yes, they are. Both these books are a sort of experiment in history writing. I try to manage to do the experiment. What happens if you don't have this, the great overarching narrative, the grand narrative, and only a book about such an event as the First World War, about a single month in World War II, by only using individual biographies that are sort of intertwined with each other? Will I still be able to get some sense of the big picture, even if the big picture is sort of omitted, only mentioned in footnotes and so on? And that's the basis for both of these books, is a sort of an experiment. What happens if you leave out the grand narrative and just build it upon individual stories?
Let me just ask you about one person from your book. In the World War II book, a fellow by the name of Poon Lim?
Ah, yes, right.
Give us a brief idea of what that story was about and why he made it into your book.
Well, the book is centered upon 4 weeks, 1 month, November 1942, and the premise being that that is, in many respects, the turning point of World War II. And I wanted a large number of people to follow, and there are not only people, but also, I mean, building a ship down in Savannah and so on, following a U-boat crew, the production of the movie Casablanca, and so on. And I wanted to have a large cast, if you understand what I mean, a large cast with many different people, different countries, different languages, different ages, and so on. Not just military men, but people from very different walks of life and on different places all around the world. And a part of the book is, of course, about the Battle of the Atlantic and so on, trying to withstand the German U-boat onslaught, because they were actually, it looks like they were winning that part of the war in October, November 42. They never sunk so many ships as in November 1942. And I wanted, of course, to have a sailor, a civilian sailor, that is one of these, that falls, participates in this war, a bit unwilling, but so on. And I found this Chinese man who was on a ship that got torpedoed in the Southern Atlantic. Many of the sailors that were killed during the battle for the Atlantic and also in the other oceans, but especially in the Atlantic, they were from non-belligerent countries. Not all of them were British or American. A lot of them were, of course, even French. But he came from China. And his ship was torpedoed, and he was left adrift in the Southern Atlantic. And he is the person that has survived for the longest time, all by himself, as a sort of a castaway, until he finally is spotted by some fishermen off the coast of Brazil. But he is left alone. The whole crew perishes. And he survives miraculously. And I thought it was a great story on Poon Lim.
So he's on this raft for 130 some days?
Yes, he has. I believe he still has the record for surviving alone at sea. Definitely surviving alone at sea after being torpedoed during World War II.
Where did you find, in what form did you find his story?
I got hold of it simply by, I had a lot of people that were sort of, I tried for these roles in the book. And I think I found him really on Google. And then I started to search through different sites, especially news sites and so on. But I was able to put together his story. He has not left a narrative of his own, but there are enough stories about him. He was decorated, and eventually he settled in, I think he settled in New York. So there are all these scraps of stories that can be puzzled together about him and what happened to him. And his sort of miraculous survival.
Correct my pronunciation at any time. Chil Rahman?
Ah, yes, yes.
The story, Treblinka, where is Treblinka located?
It's in eastern Poland. It was one of the, camps of annihilation, not a concentration camp, but a camp where people were transported just in order to be killed. And it was the camp that was constructed to take Jews from Warsaw. There were these annihilation camps. You have Sobibor, you have Bełżec, and so on. And they were built to sort of be a sort of feeder camps for the big Jewish ghettos. And he was one of the very few who survived Treblinka. He escaped during the big prisoner rebellion in Treblinka. Hid as a Gentile in Warsaw, met also a Jewish girl who had survived underground and eventually immigrated to South America. He participated in several of the trials that were post-war. And he wrote in connection, I think still during the war, he wrote a narrative of what he had seen in Treblinka.
Let me read so folks who don't have your book in front of them can get the narrative on Rachman and Treblinka. He says, and this is from your book, the standing corpses are pressed so tightly together that their hands and feet seem to be intertwined. The ramp column can't get to work until they have managed to drag out the first dozen or so bodies. After that, the piles get looser and the corpses begin to fall out of the gas chamber of their own accord. The crush arises partly because so many people are crammed into the chambers and they all become terrified and struggle to breathe. The terror of death and the jostling causes the bodies to swell up, and so the corpses become a single mass. There's enough narrative in your book like that. How did you deal with all this?
Well, as you perhaps know, I've been working as a war correspondent. That is not my main line of occupation. I'm an academic historian. So I've been to the Balkans, I've been to Afghanistan, was embedded with a U.S. unit in Iraq, and I've been to Ukraine during the war. And you see a lot of bad stuff there, but when you see it firsthand, you're sort of inured to it, sort of, not immune, but inured to it in a way that the situation makes you, it's a bad situation and things can happen to yourself. And some of the energies go into considering yourself. So I've gone through these different wars with not much scratches to my soul, but working with these narratives, it's in one sense worse, because you're sitting at my desk in the safe space of my desk, and I have nothing to hide behind. So I'm going through them, and some of these narratives they have resurfaced in my dreams in a way that seeing some really bad things in real life hasn't. I try to understand the mechanism, but I think it's, you have nothing to hide behind. You have these words, and they are gut-wrenching, some of them. Yes, as a historian, I will, of course, work through it and work with it. But some of it, when you work with it, some of it has resurfaced in my dreams, yes, bad dreams.
Now, having read your book, I need you to explain why you chose basically to take us from page to page to page during a week at a time, but not really helping me as a reader know that here's a heading, here's the person you're reading about. You can go three paragraphs on one and then go right to another person. What's the thought behind that?
Well, when I did the book on the First World War, it's about, you know, it's all the years, that's 4 years. And there I had the mechanism with the headers and so on. This is she and she, this is this date, and this is this person doing that in this geographical location. I found it a There is a, of course, a sort of, there is a clarity to it for the reader. I acknowledge that. But at the same time, I wanted the form for this one, for this book, to be even more loose, even more open. And that is, that I understand that it can be a problem. That, the book is equipped with this, you have these, the charts of all the people with their photographs and so on. And yes, perhaps it could have been made even clearer with something. I know there is some of the versions of the First World War book, they have these, all these, they have small thumbnail portraits of people and so on. But I wanted to see if you did this sort of more of a flow, a narrative that is more of a single flow, where they are arranged chronologically. But yes, you have to get used to learning by heart some of the names. Yes, you have to.
One of the people in your book is a man named Albert Camus. Who was he?
Yes, yes.
Who was he, and why did he end up in your book?
Well, he eventually turned up to be a very young Nobel Prize laureate in literature. And since 20 years, I've been a member of the Swedish Academy as well. It's the society in Stockholm, the Royal Swedish Academy, that hands out the Nobel Prize in Literature. And one of my favorites among these older Nobel Prize laureates in literature is actually Camus, which I think was a great author, but also an interesting person to have in this book, because he's not a fighter. He has not yet joined the resistance. He's sitting in a pension in France, sulking over his bad reviews over his latest book. So he's a sort of a typical person to have on a book on World War II. Because most of the people that were involved in World War II, you have the fighting men, of course, and you have the civilians that got bombed, but many, many of them were like Camus, who was dragged into it unwillingly. And at least in this phase of the war, he doesn't perhaps even want to consider it so much. And there are several people in the book who are of this quality, this brand, people who, they really are not too interested in the war, but the war is really interested in them. He is also a great author, and he has left a very interesting diary that I can use for this.
Had you
passages.
Read his work before you picked him up for this book?
Yes, he's renowned here in Sweden and in Europe, I would like to say. He, as I said, he was a very young Nobel Prize laureate, and he died young as well. A great author, I would say. He's often described as a sort of rival to Sartre, and I think he's a much more appealing, as both as a writer, as a thinker, than Jean-Paul Sartre.
You say he died in 1957 in a car accident.
Yes, yes, he did. Died too young.
One of the sub-stories throughout your book is about the movie Casablanca.
Yes.
Can you give us a little bit about why you decided to use that as a device in the book?
Well, as I mentioned, I didn't want it to be only a sort of a number of biographies that are entwined into each other, but I also wanted it to use things that there are happening interesting things in November that should not be connected to individuals, but that can be connected to phenomena. As I mentioned, I also have the building of a ship down in Savannah, but also the production and premiere of Casablanca. And I also think that Casablanca, it is interesting because what we see in it today was probably not the same thing as people did in November 1942, but it's still some of it is sort of, it fits into the pattern of the book, because it, if there is a theme in it, it's really a book about the United States wakening up to the threat of fascism. But it's also a movie that has a sort of a subdued message of, we will win eventually. They have beaten us, but now we will win. And it was, and this was part of the, I think, the appeal for the movie then. For us, it's much more a very romantic movie about love and the sacrifices of love and so on. But then it has it had a sort of a very hopeful message, which I think eludes us now, that's not living in November 1942, when the outcome of the Second World War was still, nobody knew how it would really end. And also, there is also all these small stories, you know, that are, I think they are a great part of the story. You know, Humphrey Bogart being so short and Ingrid Bergman being so long, and how they got around that and so on.
Well, the other thing that you include in the story of Casablanca is the behind the scenes among the corporate leaders who keep talking about this is a great way to make money, and that they wanted to change the ending before the premiere. Explain that.
Yes. It was really started out as a B movie with a low budget and so on. Nothing fancy. It was part of the industry, Hollywood industry, churning out movies, but also churning out movies that were supposed to be good for the war effort. So it was, the script and so on had been vetted and rewritten and so on. But what happened when November, that was, of course, Operation Torch, when the American did their very first combat landing against the Germans, against the Axis in Morocco and in Casablanca. And the film executives in New York thought that this is a great opportunity. We should use it. We could make even more of it, because we have this great title even now, Casablanca, and it could be even more box office valuable. So they had this idea to put a new ending to it, and it went very long. They wrote a new ending, where Humphrey Bogart, together with this Claude Rains, he who plays the Vichy, the corrupt Vichy police chief in Casablanca, where they return to Casablanca with the American soldiers, and they also have in the script for the new ending, they also use the authentic speech that Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave, and that was partly addressed to the French, because this was a French colony, and they were afraid that they would be fighting against the French, which they actually did. And quite a number of Frenchmen died before it was over. So they did this new ending with a landing, Humphrey Bogart landing together with this French policeman in Casablanca, and they had the extras and all. Everything was set for it, but there were a snag in the production, and eventually the producer managed to persuade people, and he got Jack Warner on his side, and Jack Warner was, of course, a formidable person to have on your side at this time in Hollywood, and so eventually they said, no, we won't change the ending, and okay. So it came very, very close to getting a completely new ending, and I think it would have ended. It would ruin the movie. It was the ending in Casablanca now is pretty perfect as it is.
You said that there was a at the premiere they had a parade in New York.
Yes, with many of the forces from the Free French forces that they could gather up in New York, and foreign legionnaires and so on. So and there is this description of the movie theater. The premiere was sent directly in the radio, so it was made into a big thing, and it was portrayed. The lobby of the cinema was portrayed more as a sort of a recruitment office than a simple cinema lobby, because you can join the Free French, you can join the, there were stalls where you can join the Free French army, you could join the Foreign Legion and so on. So it was quite an excited atmosphere.
Is it 39 people in the book? I kept trying to count them. Or is it 40?
I think you could say it's 40.
But in the back of the book, you tell us, each character in the book, you tell us what happened to them after the war.
Yes.
What was the most interesting one that you can remember of what their lives turned into being after the war was over? Just pick one of them that you remember.
That's interesting. Let me have a... I must think this over. There is a... one of the more, you know, not so very dramatic persons, as I said, it's not all fighting and military men and bombs falling and so on. It's this homemaker, this woman called Nella Last. She's a middle-aged woman who lives in a small industrial town in the eastern parts of England. And I thought about her a lot because she wrote this diary that was used, has been used a lot in research, also because it's so big. It's one of the biggest diaries in the English language. And her diary, which is an excellent source material when it comes to everyday life in World War II Britain. And many stopped after the war, but she kept on with her diary. And eventually, it's a bit of a sad story, because one of the reasons that I'm writing this book using these individuals, following these individuals, is I think that many of the complications in when we see history up close, many of the complications become really clear on an individual level. And you can find this Nella Last, this woman, middle-aged woman, who has she is against Hitler. She's a tiny bit anti-Semitic. She, in contrast to her husband, she encouraged both her boys to go to war, because it's her husband that wants to keep them at home, and she says, go. She's rather a bit critical of Churchill. And the prospect of the war going on, it really comes to her. At the same time, the war has transformed her life in a positive way. And that's interesting. And you see that she steps out of this cocoon as a homemaker, and her talents and her hours and her working hours and her working capacities are demanded outside the home. And she starts looking at the world in a new way. And I think this is a story of many women who, before the war, were sort of confined to the homes and that small life they had there. And then came the war, and they started working in industry, which it did for a while, or had other different engagements. And she is feeling better and better for herself during the war. Then after the war, you have this woman who is getting stronger and stronger during the war, paradoxically enough. And then afterwards, it slowly peters out. And she continues with her diary. And in the diary, you could, for instance, see that she is growing more and more desperately bored with her husband. And then you see that all this energy that the war gave her, and she was forced to muster, after the war, it sort of peters out. And she lives in this unhappy marriage until she dies in the 60s or more. She continues to write this enormous diary. But you can also see that in one sense, the war years were the best years of her life. And you know, that is also this the title of this great American movie. And for some of them, it was the best years of their life, not just because they were young, but because it gave them something.
Are all 12 million words that she wrote available for the public to read?
I can't guarantee that. I think so, actually. As I said, it is one of the largest diaries in the English language ever. And it has been mined by historians, anthropologists, and so on. So it's a wonderful source material. And you cannot, when you have this mass, you cannot be but touched by this person. She is interesting in all her everyday life routines and so on.
I counted 14 of your 40 people as they were women.
Yes.
How hard was it for you to find women to include in the book? And where was the obvious place that you found their writings?
It was not so difficult, really. When I wrote the book on the First World War, I made a sort of, at first startling, but soon I realized it was a startling discovery that, which I soon realized was quite logical, is that most of the most dramatic stories, they of course come from the men, because many of them, if you are in action, you have a very dramatic stories to tell, but also that you're sort of, well, the moral universe is very small. Your universe is very small because you are concerned with yourself, with your comrades, and so on, trying to survive. But in the First World War book, I noticed that many of the most acute observations, psychologically, and also of everyday life, they are made of women, because their universe is not as dramatic or sort of constricted by dramatic events. The war opens up their world, and they have this opportunity to see and observe and take note of. So I knew when I started working on the book that I wanted women not just to have a sort of quota, but I knew also that in these circumstances, that many of the most acute psychological observations are made by women, because they are not in the thick of it. If you are a woman and in the thick of it, then the same phenomenon applies. It's sort of your world shrinks, because you are fighting for your survival, and that's quite natural. Well, it wasn't difficult. And I understood quite early that the problem with this book would not be finding people that could inhabit these 4 weeks in 1942. That would not be the problem. The problem was to be, which ones would I choose?
Why did you pick Anne Sommerhausen?
I picked her because she was from Belgium. And I could have picked other ones, but I wanted someone I wanted occupied Europe. And I have this, which is a fantastic, Hélène Barre, a young French woman in Paris during occupation. I wanted someone from some other occupied countries in Western Europe, which also stood for a different attitude toward the German occupation. Because the attitude and the mechanics of the German occupations, they were different, especially if you compared Holland and Belgium. Holland was much stricter, a much more violent occupation than in Belgium. Belgium was building very, very much on cooperation, collaboration. So therefore, I thought that Belgium was interesting because it was this model occupation with a lot of collaborate, building on collaboration. Really a very small occupying force. And she was sort of part of this, working for a firm, working for the German government. So I found her interesting for that reason. Belgium stands for all these different countries, you know, France. The occupation in Poland can never be compared to the occupation that was in, say, Denmark. And there is differences between even Holland and Belgium. So I would try to find these differences, which try to disappear under the cliche of German occupation. It was different German occupations.
Which one of your people that you write about do you take us into the trenches, into the worst of the war itself?
Well, there are several. There is one, a private in the Red Army outside of Stalingrad, who participates. He's 19 when it starts. He participates in the pincer movement around Stalingrad, and his unit gets, you know, worn down. Just in a couple of weeks, I think they lose the majority of the fighting numbers. So he's really in the thick of it. And then there is, of course, we have an American Walker, who is a young officer on Guadalcanal. He's also in the thick of it. I had some help finding him, a Japanese infantry lieutenant, I think, who is actually one of the opposites of Walker on Guadalcanal. And he eventually gets killed in the beginning of December. But these really, they are really in the thick of it and in the worst part of it. There is also, I have these, he is a soldier in the Australian army, and he fights on New Guinea. And it's also absolutely horrendous. In both New Guinea and Guadalcanal, the Japanese are starving. And there is these, you know, you have cannibalism and so on, and sort of things really falling apart. And the stories there, are horrible.
How much?
Guadalcanal was really a hellhole.
When you've, how many of these soldier types had an actual diary that you found?
Well, most of them. So Abdulin, I'm not sure that he, what I have read is a sort of, he has written a memoir, but it's so detailed that I think it can be, it is probably based on a diary. Sometimes you can see this in memoirs based on diaries. You have these slip-ups when it's come to past and present tense and so on. So you can see that, okay, this is probably a diary. The Japanese infantry officer, he left a diary. He managed to get it out. He was wounded in the fighting. And he was given the opportunity to be evacuated from Guadalcanal, but he said no. He wanted to stay with his men. He was killed just a couple of days. His old battalion was wiped out, but the diary got back to Japan, and it is now in the Yakusuni Shrine. You know, where all the commemorate the memory of those Japanese war fallen. So having access to the diary, I had help with a Japanese research assistant, and we had to get the permission from the Yakusumi Shrine to use it. But that was really a diary. So also the Walker, the army officer on Guadalcanal, he was obviously also using a diary.
Of all the people you write about, which one would you most like to meet?
Ooh, that's a good question. There are two of them, and neither of them survived the war. One is a British tanker. He's a lieutenant in an armored unit, participating in the Battle of El Alamein. His name is Keith Douglas, and he was studied in Oxford before the war. He was a bit of a poet, and he, after participating in the campaign from El Alamein and onwards, he went back to the United Kingdom and finished his narrative of what he's seen, obviously based on the diary, and had it finished just in time when he participated in Overlord in the invasion of Normandy in June 1944, where he was killed just after a couple of days after getting ashore. And he is a very intelligent, observant writer, and he was obviously was a sort of a scholar in his own right, and he was a poet and so on. So his book about what he's seen is a great one, and I think it would be able to have a very interesting conversation with him. Then there is another person that didn't survive the war, and he is a German. He was a private. It's called Willy Peter Reese. He was on the Eastern Front, and he left a diary, and he also left a number of letters, which he was sent regularly to his parents. He was obviously not a Nazi, but still harboring this conflicting emotion. He hates the war, but he can't leave it. And those that... he would never be a deserter. You think that is wrong. So he's very much in conflict with himself. But he also has this ability to see himself and what's happening to him from the outside. And he's talking about, he's becoming more and more of a stranger to himself. And this is also someone very, very intelligent, with a very sharp eye for detail and so on. And I would have loved to have talked to him as well. Also, both of them were great literary promises. But he disappeared in 1945 in the great Soviet summer offensive, and no one knows what happened.
Let me go back to Keith Douglas and read a paragraph that you have in your book so you can get an idea of how he was thinking. It is exciting and amazing to see thousands of men, very few of whom have much idea why they are fighting, all enduring hardships, living in an unnatural, dangerous, but not wholly terrible world, having to kill and be killed, and yet at intervals moved by a feeling of comradeship with men who kill them and whom they kill because they are enduring and experiencing the same things. It is tremendously illogical to read about it. Cannot convey the impression of having walked through the looking glass which touches a man entering a battle.
Yes. And I think this is one of the points using this. I have this large number of people, because there is not one single attitude to this war, this experience. This is not one single way to handle it, what these people are experiencing. And that is also my own My own experience, that is, of course, much more limited, that people handle these things and they have attitudes that are often conflicting. There is not one single attitude, how people behave or how people how they think about war.
We are recording this in the middle of the day here in the United States, but it's close to, I believe, what, 7 o'clock where you are?
Yes, indeed.
Tell us where is it Uppsala? Is that the way you pronounce it, or Uppsala?
Uppsala is okay, yes. Uppsala is, it's a small, it's a university town. Okay, it's the fourth largest town in Sweden, but that doesn't account for much. Sweden is a small country. It's a sort of Swedish Oxford. It's a university town. The university was founded in the 15th century, a couple of years after Columbus discovered the Americas. It's close. It's some 70 kilometers from Stockholm. And that's about it.
Am I reading a translation of your book, or did you write it in English?
It is very much a translation. I have tried to write some text, wrote some text for the Financial Times and so on, directly. But writing such a large text, I would think that would be impossible.
What's the Swedish Academy, and what have you done in that academy? How long have you been associated with it?
Well, the Swedish Academy, it was founded in the 18th century by one of our kings, and he sort of made it a copy of the French Academy, and it hands out prizes, and it's also meant to further the interest of the language and of the literature. And as I said, we hand out prizes, literary prizes, and the most well-known, of course, is the Nobel Prize. I've been a member of the Swedish Academy for some 20-odd years, and I also been, for a couple of years, I was the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy.
I'm going to read something from your website, and I want you to explain this.
Okay.
I think you probably know what I'm going to read. However, I want to warn in advance, : in addition to being a present father in every way, I am also extremely jealous of my time these days. The years as permanent secretary have left their mark. My opportunities to answer historical questions, lecture, etc., are therefore minimal. Furthermore, I have not without some relief come out of the closet as a self-confessed introvert. So nowadays, I don't appear on a stage without very good reasons. It's sad, unfortunately. Why did you want us to know that? And are you pulling our chain, as we would say in the United States, or do you really feel that way?
No, I really feel that way. It was working as a permanent secretary for these years for the Academy. It's a very very public office, sort of. You are always in the public eye, especially when you present who will get the award, who will get the Nobel Prize in literature and so on. And it really sort of filled my quota for the rest of my life, standing on the stage. And I think if you are a writer, you will, it's always very, very nice to be on a stage and get all these applause and kudos and so on. But if you are a writer, you will sooner or later reach the point where you say, okay, enough is enough. Now, just let me do what I want. That is, I want to write, not be an expert in TV, and not be, you know, stand around on stages and so on. So, and I think it's very easy for me to say that. As I said, I am a self-confessed introvert. So, which I think many, or even most, authors are. You wouldn't choose that very lonely profession if you weren't, in some respect, a dedicated, not perhaps recluse, but at least introvert.
Back to your book. You have a person in your book by the name, and I'm not sure I can pronounce it right, Mun Akçu, or Okçu?
Yes, yes.
Who was she?
Yes. Well, that is one of the, as I said, O I must have this one in the narrative. And she was a sex slave in a Japanese army bordello, a whorehouse in Mandalay, only 18 years old. And I found out about her because she was part of a big, what's it called? When you sue in a group, what's it called? What's the, I don't know what the American phrase for it. You have a, you sue someone as a collective. And she was part of a sort of a collective litigation against the Japanese. She's Korean. She was Korean. She was a Korean sex slave in a Japanese army bordello. And she was in the 90s, she was part of a group litigation against the Japanese state for they wanted to have, what's it called in English? You get paid for damages. She was part of this group litigation against the Japanese state in the 90s. And as a part of this group litigation, she told her whole story about being a sex slave in the Japanese army during World War II. And it's a story. I never heard of it. I've heard about a phenomenon, but I've never heard about, you know, these individual stories. And that was also hers. I could piece together part of the story from different sources, of course, many different sources, including, you know, intelligence briefings that were done during the war, where the whole system of these official army prostitution is organized army prostitution, where it was outlined, and very good intelligence reports that I read. But her story was, of course, the individual story was, of course, needed, and it's also a ghastly story. At the same time, that it is a bit complicated as well, because she gets money. And she is able to have some quasi freedom to roam about there. And in the end of the war, she gets enrolled as a sort of an army nurse. So it's a complicated story, and still rather horrible. And I never seen that on that individual level. So I thought, when I stumbled across her, I thought that she must be in this narrative.
You say that she died in 1996. Plagued by disease, insomnia, and shame.
Yes, indeed.
Did that
as
come out?
Word.
Did that come out in her writing?
That came out in the writing surrounding her, because all these women that were prostitutes, sex slaves of the Japanese army, they were shunned when they returned home after the war, and they were never really accepted again. And she couldn't have children because of the venereal diseases that she had again and again and again. And as I said, she was shunned, as most of them were shunned by their families, shunned by the communities and so on. So they had it was a horrible fate for these women. And that they eventually did this litigation against the Japanese government. It was a good thing.
I have to say that if you're in a hurry reading your book, it's not a good idea, because everybody should read your footnotes. And I'm going to read one now because it's in connection with what we're just talking about. Yeah. This footnote says, the victories won by Japan during 1941 and 1942 were all accompanied by massacres, big or small. The atrocities, for the most part, were unplanned and committed almost in passing. You use the French word. They were an expression of the general brutality and sense of superiority of the Japanese military.
Yes.
I don't know that you want to answer this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Of all the people that you read about and you've written about, the Japanese, the Germans, the Americans, the Soviets, is there one of that group that are more vicious, more evil than others?
Well, you can have this feeling about there are none of them. Of course, if you follow the Jewish man who works in a, he is a Totenjude, as it's called. He's a death Jew in the inner circle in Treblinka. He's doing the workings, participating in the workings of the killing machine. Those people, the SS men, he meets there. They are vicious, but also very obvious. They are also very morally corrupt. Then again, you know, the Japanese army lieutenant and the Japanese, they are vicious. The Japanese units that the Americans meet in Guadalcanal, I think one of them participated in the rape of Nanking. And also the Japanese army lieutenant, which is he's a sensitive, intelligent man. His unit participated in massacres in Hong Kong at the fall of Hong Kong. And I cannot be sure that he didn't participate. You can find nothing in his diary, but his unit participated in it. And there was a culture. There was a culture in the Japanese army that was, I would say, rather nasty when it comes to how you treat enemies and especially how you treat prisoners, that eventually came out how they treated their own people in some respects. But they were vicious. I remember I saw an interview with a British, he had been fighting in Burma, and he said about the Japanese soldiers in that they were great fighters, but animals. So, yes, and I think that is very much a soldiers and armies are always a reflection of the society from which they emerge. And I think that the extremely militaristic and imperialistic Japan had this, the army and the culture in the Japanese army, it was vicious.
Who would you name as the best writer of everybody you talk about?
Who are in the book?
Yes. Just a writer. The actual,
yes.
Yeah.
I would say that is a German, a middle-aged army captain, an author, Ernst Jünger. And he's probably the best. Probably the best writer of them all. An interesting aside, you know, that Willy Peter Reese, that private infantryman on the Eastern Front, he was one of the admirers of Jünger. Jünger is a very, I think he's an excellent author, very, very intelligent, keen observer, but also a complicated man. But of all these men, I would say that he's probably one of the best. One of the persons on the other side of the Eastern Front, of the Soviet side, is of course Vasily Grossman, who was a reporter for the Red Army newspaper in Stalingrad. And Vasily Grossman, I would say, also is one of the greatest authors of the 20th century. I would say he could have been given the Nobel Prize in Literature. He's written some of the best books ever on the Second World War when it comes to fiction, and also great reporter. So he's also a great author.
How long?
Go ahead. I'm becoming a bit unsure. As Jünger is a very brainy author, bit of an egghead. But you cannot read a paragraph of him but not being impressed by his acute sensibility and his intelligence and his sharp, very sharp pen. While Grossman, Vasily Grossman, at the same time has some, his humanity, the sheer humanity in what he's writing and when he's writing about people is very, very touching. Ernst Jünger is a very skillful author, but a bit cold. Vasily Grossman is someone with a very big heart, and he loves people.
Here's another footnote. In 1944, the American Postal Service banned the overseas shipment of Esquire on the grounds that its illustrations were immoral.
Yeah.
The ban resulted in a storm of raids that went all the way up to Congress. A number of similar magazines existed on the British side, but there were above all was the cartoon character Jane in the Daily Mirror, who habitually tended to lose items of her clothing. Anyway, were you surprised to find out, or what is your reaction to the fact that Esquire, the American Postal Service, banned it?
This is really a footnote, and I love footnotes, as you have already surmised. No, not that surprised, as there was in America, there was a, we have this, you have this tradition of moralism in the United States. You have, you know, you have the prohibition and so on. You have a sort of a moral fervor that is hard to find in Europe. It would never happen in Europe. And as it, this is this comparison with in the United Kingdom, it was worse there. But it's the same thing when I wrote the book on the First World War. Both French and British, they react over the Americans having, they find them to sort of Sunday school-ish. They have these prohibitions when it comes to what you could read and what you can drink and so on. And so it's already a part of the image of the American, that they are entering Europe, they're entering this cultural sphere with much more restrictions on what you can do and what you cannot do and so on.
What, this is probably an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it again anyway. What book, the first one, I know you've written 10, 11 books. What's the book that you, let me start from the beginning. Which book of the two, World War One and now World War Two, did you personally enjoy writing the most?
It was this one. It was this one. It, for the first time, I enjoyed a long writing career, but this one, when I finished this one, for the first time, I felt a bit of a bit melancholy. I've heard about it. I read about it. You know, writers feeling sad when they finish a project, especially a big one. I have never experienced that, but this one, the work was so intense. And much of it took place during COVID. Not all of it, but much of it took place during COVID. So it was also this atmosphere being hunkered down, and the world closing in, or not closing down, rather. I lost my mother in COVID and so on. It was a very special atmosphere, and I actually went through a divorce at the same time. So this was the, writing this book was a sort of a, that was really a safe space for me. It was something that I could look forward to doing. And also the material, the people. When I knew that someone was going to finish someone and someone was going to be written out and so on, it was sort of, could feel a sort of a pang of parting. So it really took me writing this book, but it was enjoyable in that way. And when it was over, I was a bit sad.
Are you working on another book?
No, I'm not. I've done some reporting on the war in Ukraine, and I'm going back to hopefully to Ukraine soon. So that has been taking a lot of my energies and so on. And I don't believe really in going directly from one project to another. I need not, and I think I should not. So I'm considering what to do next. But right now, I'm pretty much concerned and giving my energies to what's happening in Ukraine.
I could ask you 150 more questions, but I'm not going to do that to you. You've spent an hour with us, and I really appreciate it. I want to go over the title of the book, November 1942, An Intimate History of the Turning Point of World War II, by Peter Englund, who is in Uppsala, Sweden. How far from how far are you from Stockholm?
70 kilometers approximately. So it's pretty close.
It is. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for the book.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to the Book Notes Plus podcast. Please rate and review Book Notes Plus, and don't forget to follow so you never miss an episode. Questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.